From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Thousands of angry Egyptians flooded Cairo's Tahrir Square Friday, denouncing President Mohamed Morsi for betraying the revolution that opened his path to the presidency. Egypt is deeply divided, Morsi's legitimacy shaken, the country's economy crippled, its youth fed up. This hour on Point, we go to the front lines in Egypt to try to understand where that country is headed. You can join the conversation. Why is Egypt still in such turmoil? What do you see coming from the biggest player in the Arab Spring? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll catch up with the latest developments in Syria. There's been a lot going on in and around Syria. And in a moment, we'll get the perspective of a young Egyptian leader in Tahrir Square 2 years ago who is fiercely protesting again in Egypt. On Friday, protesters took to the streets of Port Said in Egypt to declare their unhappiness with President Morsi. That came almost a week after President Morsi, January 27th, used his executive power in an attempt to defuse violent protests.
After consulting the Constitution, I have decided to declare a state of emergency in the provinces of Suez, Port Said, and Ismailia for 30 days from midnight tonight. Secondly, there will be a curfew for residents of Port Said, Suez, and Ismailia during this period of emergency, and no one should venture out from 9 p.m. till 6 a.m. the following day.
Reminded a lot of people of the bad old Mubarak days. Here's the sound of Friday of protesters in Cairo supporting others in Port Said. Let's go to Cairo. Joining us first from the Egyptian capital is Nancy Youssef. She's been reporting on all the turmoil for McClatchy newspapers. Nancy, welcome back to On Point. Thank you for joining us.
Great to be with you.
And with us from Washington, Samer Shahada, Egyptian-born professor of Arab politics at Georgetown University and author of Islamist Politics in the Middle East. Samer Shahada, welcome back to you as well.
My pleasure.
Nancy, what has kicked off this big latest round of very fierce protests?
Well, this round started in Port Said, where there was a court verdict in the death of 74 football fans at a stadium who were stampeded to death on February 1st, 2012. A judge sentenced 21 people, mainly from Port Said, in the stampeding death of their rival fans from Al Ahli, who the Cairo team. And this spurred off the first round of protests in Port Said. And from there, it escalated because people were killed in those protests, and then I got funerals for those 32 killed the day before, and it's just been one thing building on another. So we've had, as a result, 60 people killed for the call for execution for 21 people who were held responsible for the death of 34 people. So it's, or excuse me, 74 people. So it's become one thing building on another. What's interesting about Port Said is that it wasn't part of the revolution in 2011. This is a port town, relatively wealthy, and their frustration sort of all came out from this very important court hearing and the fact that the security forces weren't ready for the potential upheaval, despite the fact that everybody knew that this hearing could spark protests.
60 dead in the streets of Egypt in this round of protests. Nancy, why were the convictions of soccer fans such a big political issue?
Yeah, it's a great question. A little bit of background. These two teams have been rivals for decades. This is Al-Masri versus Al-Ahli, Al-Masri representing Port Said, Al-Ahli representing Cairo. And here, the fans are part of these groups called ultras, and they're not only fans, but they've become a political movement that have been able to galvanize people on the streets. And so that was part of it. I think what's happening in Egypt is that every sort of potential event has become a catalyst for people to express their frustrations with the government. In Port Said, as in other places, unemployment is rising. The economic opportunities that they thought would come from the revolution aren't happening. And I think most importantly, People are not seeing an improvement in the way the police conduct themselves with Egyptian citizens. Remember that the uprising in 2011 didn't start as an effort to get rid of Mubarak. It started as a protest against police brutality. And so what we're seeing in Egypt is every time there's a key event, a key ruling, a key speech, a key decision, it's become a flashpoint for all these mounting frustrations amongst people.
And of course, Samer, those 74 deaths at that soccer match a year ago, police widely seen as complicit in that high death toll and widely interpreted as engaged in some roundabout, some payback in these 21 death penalties here. Put it in the bigger context for us, Samer. What is going on with Egypt? We've got a top general warning of the collapse of the state. We hear that with some skepticism because, of course, that could be used as an excuse for the military to come back in. But is it at that point? Are things coming apart at the seams, Samer?
Things are almost coming apart at the seams. And this has been, I would think, the most critical period in Egypt's history since Mubarak was ousted on February 11th, 2011. Because what we've seen, as Nancy described and as you have implied, is something we haven't seen before. We've seen polarization, of course, between political forces, mostly Islamists and non-Islamists. But what we saw over the last 2 weeks was that polarization now transform itself into the withdrawal of legitimacy by citizens, by many citizens, to the institutions of the state, and not just the individual occupants of power, not just Mr. Morsi as president and so on, but to the state itself. And we've also seen something else over this last period, which we haven't really seen before. We've seen protests and really violence and so on that seem to be out of the control of any political group, the opposition elements and so on, and it's not clear that they can fully rein that back in. So almost coming apart at the seams, and certainly the most critical period that Egypt has witnessed since Mubarak's ouster 2 years ago.
Here's a tape of an Egyptian citizen. This was in Port Said on Friday. Big demonstrations there again and beyond, and criticizing President Morsi. Morsi, who had been in Germany, in Berlin, talking with the Germans about economic issues when lots of things were blowing up here. Morsi, who's been critical of Bashar Assad in Syria. Here's this Egyptian going at the Egyptian president, saying he should leave if he doesn't stop the bloodshed.
President Morsi in Berlin was calling on President Bashar to leave power and to stop the bloodshed in Syria. He should concentrate on stopping the bloodshed here in Egypt first, or he should leave.
Nancy Youssef, in Cairo, does it look to you as though we have a collapse of the state potentially on the table? Does Morsi appear to be going anywhere? If he stays, does that mean stability or the opposite?
Well, the problem is when you ask people in the streets as they're chanting that people want the end of the regime, who would replace Morsi? And some people will say we want a new election. Well, are we going to have new elections here every 6 months? And even if there were new elections, who would replace him? Remember that under Mubarak, there wasn't the opportunity for opposition groups to really properly formulate. And so nobody can point to a clear alternative. Is it the collapse of the state? Potentially that. When you go through Cairo now, it's shocking how little control there is. Around the U.S. Embassy, for example, there's debris everywhere and police unable to really rein people in. As Sumer mentioned, the Morsi will call on the opposition to rein the people in. They can't do it any better. And you do get the sense that, I don't know if the state is collapsing per se, but you get the sense that nobody is in control. And that is really bleeding into Egypt's already flailing economic situation. The Egyptian pound is falling by the day, and with that, prices are going up for everybody at a time when unemployment is also rising. For many people, the very ones that are out protesting in the streets. So the spirit of the revolution seems broken, and there's a loss of faith and the ability of the government to control the situation or to make the kinds of reforms that people had hoped for. I don't even know how to properly describe it. It feels like a state spinning out of control.
Samer, is it possible to imagine a country the size of Egypt? It's an enormous population, an enormous economy, even if it's in deep trouble. Is it possible to imagine it collapsing into anarchy, chaos, failed state status, or is there some, obvious order that could or would be imposed somewhere, somehow?
I think we're still a long way away from that. And I don't think that the chances are high that Egypt would fall into a failed state. Certainly, rule of law could deteriorate, as I mentioned. Mm-hmm. The legitimate authority of the state could deteriorate, but we're not there yet. And I think that there is potentially a process for moving in a more positive direction. And that largely lies on the shoulders of Mohamed Morsi, the president, who has acted has had an abysmal performance so far, really, and has been criminally negligent with regard to the deaths that you discussed earlier. So if Morsi and his Muslim Brotherhood Freedom and Justice Party move in a different direction than they have been over the last 6 months, in a direction that actually includes members of the opposition, that is pluralistic as opposed to monopolizing power, that doesn't delegitimize the opposition and so on, and that vests them in the political process, then in addition, of course, to an economic recovery, or at least the stopping of the economic hemorrhage, then we can potentially move in a positive direction. And I think we're going to see that in the next 3 or 4 months, with parliamentary elections scheduled for April, with, of course, the IMF loan and negotiations taking place between the government and the International Monetary Fund, and so on.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the crisis in Egypt and where it goes. The whole world watching in the last week or two as things have gotten very, very ugly in some Egyptian cities. Calls for Mohamed Morsi, the president, to go. Others behind him. Fears of something like anarchy, but maybe not. Nancy Youssef is with us from Cairo. She covers the Middle East for McClatchy newspaper. Samer Shahada is with us from Georgetown University, professor of Arab politics there. And we're going to go in just a moment to Cairo and one of those young people, young leaders who was in the square, Tahrir Square, in 2011. In January and February of that year, PBS Frontline followed Gigi Ibrahim in the thick of Egypt's revolution, spoke to her as news spread in Tahrir Square, February 11th, 2011, that Hosni Mubarak had stepped down. Here she is from the documentary Gigi's Revolution. Revolution has succeeded. The voice of Gigi Ibrahim on February 11th, 2011 in Tahrir Square. She joins us now from Cairo. Egyptian journalist, blogger, activist. She was a high-profile leader 2 years ago, was on the cover of Time magazine. She remains very politically active in opposition. Joins us by Skype right now from Cairo. Gigi Ibrahim, thank you very much for joining us. What happened to the revolution that we heard you say there has succeeded? What happened to it, Gigi?
Well, hello, everyone. And I should have said really that it has succeeded so far because, you know, no revolution succeeds or even ends in 18 days. But in those 18 days, we had succeeded to just take out, you know, the top of the regime, the head of the regime, which is Mubarak. But everything else was still in place. So we knew at that time that even then, yes, we fought, we won this point, but the road is still long and it's very steep. And we are still continuing 2 years after. I can't say much has happened. It's even gotten worse at times. We are still seeing bloodshed. We're still seeing there is an absence, a complete absence of a political will from whoever came in power, whether it be SCAF at first or and then the elected president, Morsi. There is no political will to adhere to the demands of the revolution, which are basically not rocket science. They are basic demands that we have provided 10 million ways to make them happen, but the absence of a political will from whoever is power, whoever in power, after Mubarak, physically to adhere to them, whether it be simple. Things that can be done in the social justice department or in the freedom, political, you know, laws and so on, and the reformation or even the restructuring of the police, the interior ministry, all of these demands have been loud and clear from day one. Since we were in the square, there are specialists that provided, and NGOs and political movements and human rights organizations, and so many people that worked so hard those 2 years to provide those in power with solutions, steps, you know, very clear steps to take in order to move in the right direction. But the failure of Morsi to adhere to those or even to listen to it is basically what's causing all this unrest, because people have not given all this life and on all this blood and all this time and effort, and we've waited all this time for this to give up now on these basic human rights demands.
Gigi Ibrahim, why have the reforms that you and others hoped for in Tahrir Square in those days, why have they not happened?
I believe because it's not in the interest of those who came in power. Simply, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood and Morsi, his clan, you know, his party, all of these people have collaborated very much with the old regime. Maybe not in a direct way, and they played the opposition, you know, for a very long time. So they're playing politics. They want to hold on to power, and they will not take political decisions that will hurt their own benefits, like the business tycoon Khairat al-Shatir. You know, he's not going to be willing to pay his workers, you know, a livable minimum wage. No, he wants to keep the minimum wage to a slave wage, and that's kind of the contradictions that we as leftists and as revolutionary socialists, this is the group I belong to, wanted that Morsi to come into power so that be exposed of these contradictions, and hope that the revolution will really put forth a clear alternative to power that is truly representative of the revolution. Because until now, the opposition has failed to put forth a popular alternative that people would gather behind. Like Nancy was saying earlier, you know, there is no alternative. So people are taking to the streets, you know, they're venting their anger. There's really nothing to turn to. But as long as the revolution doesn't put forth a clear alternative to power, we will have to basically, you know, fight this out and pressure whoever comes into power to adhere to our demands. But until then, you know, the revolution continues.
Gigi Ibrahim, why would the Morsi regime collaborate with the old regime? Now, we know that, you know, any number of people have been put in prison, including Mubarak. You say they're willing to collaborate. Why would they want to do that? Why would they do it? Do they not have the power to change old dynamics, old economic interests?
It's simply because it doesn't interest them to change. They were obviously benefiting. You know, there was kind of somewhat of a deal made between the you know, the so-called opposition Muslim Brotherhood. Because I mean, if they were a true opposition, they had a lot of opportunities. I mean, they had 80 seats in parliament. We didn't find anything that has changed under Mubarak when, you know, the largest opposition was part of the parliament under Mubarak. There were, I mean, even to the January 25th protest itself, I mean, the Muslim Brotherhood was not part of it, and they actually put out a statement that day that they wouldn't be taking part of these protests because that they believed in reform and they didn't believe in street action and they didn't believe in the revolution. But now you see them all hailing the revolution, you know, hijacking the revolution, talking in the name of the revolution, because they simply just want to get to power and then do their own thing, just like the NDP did and just like they will continue to do, because it's in their interest. They're businessmen with beards.
Businessmen with beards. Nancy Youssef, yes. Talk to us about Gigi Ibrahim and what she represents. She was prominent in Tahrir Square in 2011, and afterwards she's with the Revolutionary Socialists. Does she and her dissatisfaction, is it representative of the mainstream of those who came out to change the power structure in Egypt, Nancy?
Well, she doesn't, in the sense that during 2011, it was so representative in terms of those who came forth and called for Mubarak to resign. It was a mosaic of groups, including the Muslim Brotherhood. But after his presidency fell, there was a real split in terms of the way ahead.
And I think what Gigi represents is people who are frustrated with the Muslim Brotherhood approach, who see the Muslim Brotherhood and see Morsi in particular as someone, instead of trying to carry out the dreams of the revolution, is going for a power grab. Remember that Morsi, when he came into office, the first thing he did was give himself legislative power. At one point, he tried to give himself judicial power. And they see the Muslim Brotherhood as essentially trying to use his presidency as a way to grab power. The Constitution really reflects the interests of the Muslim Brotherhood. And you were asking earlier in terms of why they would want to do it this way. And Gigi got at this. To survive 84 years under the old state doesn't make you revolutionary in the sense that you were in some ways part of the system. That is, you survive by being a part of the system.
Right.
And the argument becomes that what the Brotherhood is doing is looking to replace Mubarak's National Democratic Party with their own people, their own Muslim Brotherhood people. That is, rather than being a member of the National Democratic Party to get business deals or contracts, that you now have to be a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, and that's why we haven't seen the kinds of changes that many people had hoped for.
So if I may, let me go to Samer Shahada in Washington. Samer, here's a listener online saying, this never was an Arab Spring, the listener writes. This is how the Middle East replaces its leaders. Revolution, promised reform, dictatorship. It's a cynical view, Samer. Is it legitimate?
I don't think it's legitimate, and there's not sufficient data to make that conclusion. I mean, we have seen significant change in a number of countries, including Tunisia, and certainly I think it would be premature to judge the success or failure or the possibility of democracy in a place like Egypt only 2 years after an uprising, not a revolution, that, as Gigi mentioned, was able to oust the head of the state but did nothing to the other institutions of an authoritarian regime that had been in power for more than 30 years, but really since 1952. So it's not the case. What's implicit in the person's statement is somehow the Middle East or Arabs or Muslims can't be democratic, and there's no evidence of that. And so I think, it has to be remembered, and Gigi and Nancy pointed this out, that the Muslim Brotherhood is not a revolutionary organization. They did not participate in the protests on January 25, January 26, January 27. They only mobilized on January 28th when they saw which direction the wind was blowing. On February 6, 2011, they went back to the negotiating table with Mubarak, and there's evidence that they would have made a deal with him. And so they are not committed to the ideals that Gigi and many other young activists who really initiated this revolution are committed to. They want gradual change. It's not clear. I think it's clear now that they have some serious misgivings about liberal democracy, and they certainly want to consolidate their power and possibly, and dominate political life. So yes, it's not unexpected in some senses that with the Muslim Brotherhood in power, we are at where we are now in Egypt.
Let's go to our listeners. There are many. Hoda in Boston is calling. Hoda, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Tom. I wanted to say that I have voted for Morsi, but I am very disappointed at his performance.
Are you an Egyptian? Are you Egyptian, Hoda? I guess
I'm an Egyptian American.
Okay. Yes, oh,
I've been here for 17 years, and I'm voting through the process here and by mail.
Sure.
I feel that he's not talking to the people. He's very quiet. He only reacts when something big happens. People look for a leadership, and it's not there. I am not saying that I have someone else in mind to represent Egypt other than him, because I am very disappointed with al-Baradei and all the other opposition leaders who are thinking only about themselves. And I'm starting to think that unless this generation is completely gone and we have a new generation of people who grow up in more of a democratic state, we will not have a solution, because every leader seems to only think about their own agenda.
Hoda, let me ask you, how would you do it? How would you clean, let's say, the police? There's a lot of criticism of the police in Egypt for corruption and worse, but there they are. They've got power and guns and clubs, and how would you clean it up?
There has to be gradual. We need to look at other countries who have done that through a gradual process, replacing the police leaders with other ones that are not corrupt. But we have to do something. We can't just sit there and just act whenever a disaster happens. And until this happens, I don't see much hope for us.
Hoda, you sound like a very sensible voter, though, and I appreciate your call. Let me get one more, if I may. Cayman's calling from New Orleans, Louisiana. Cayman, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks. My original question was about unemployment, the effect of unemployment on these protests, making people available to protest. But I, as I'm listening to the show, I think the bigger question might be some more airtime for the kinds of employers that were there during Mubarak, and the kinds of employers that are still there, that are willing, that want the. I mean, I work in the oil business,
yeah,
and that's Egypt. So, I mean, where are the employers? How's Tunisia doing coming back online again after their spring? And the question would be for the 7 million government workers that are still in place. I heard on some other show recently, how is that employment being paid for? And how is, you know, people have to have bread and all these issues. But
sure. Cayman, let us pick it up right there, if we may. Gigi Ibrahim in Cairo. You have a terrible economy in Egypt at this point. Of course, under Mubarak, you had a tremendously crony-style economy where lots and lots of big contracts went to his supporters. So you hear Cayman's question, how do you get the economy going? What about the employers? You're a revolutionary socialist. Do you want a socialist system? Is that the way to go? Can you have businessmen and reform in Egypt?
Well, you know, we can't have the USSR all over again. That's not our idea or my idea of socialism.
Okay.
I mean, that was state capitalism. So we can't possibly install, you know, socialism right away. And that's not how it's going to happen. But there are a few steps and demands that, if applicable, and they only need a political will to do them. I think it will improve the economy, which is basically you do a maximum wage in the public sector, and you rise you raise the minimum wage. This has been a demand since 2008, okay? And we're in 2013, and it still not has happened. Why is that? What we have in Egypt in the public sector, especially. You have, ministers and heads of governmental institutions and so on that get paid millions and millions of Egyptian pounds a year, and you get the poor person, it gets pennies. Like the gap is so huge. So if you tighten that gap, people will have food. You know, we literally have people that don't have food to eat. You know, there is a shortage of fuel. There is a shortage of electricity. The roads are completely impossible to go through. I mean, if you've been in Cairo, you know what traffic is like, and that's because of the roads. So really, there are simple things. We're far beyond fixing the complete economy and restructuring from a capitalist system to a socialist system. That's not even on the table. We are just talking here few steps that to make the lives of Egyptians better, and this needs only a political will. This is not a huge economist formula. This is 101 basic thing that can be done. And Morsi was provided with many options and many solutions by specialists and economists that think what should be done. I mean, I'm not an economist, but something like that I know for a fact will help Egypt. Another thing, I agree completely with Dr. Samer when he was talking about, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood coming in and so on, but I think what's happening right now is exactly what Nancy said, is basically what Morsi's doing is replacing Mubarak's men with his own men.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the crisis in Egypt and where it goes. We'll also spend a few minutes in this segment looking at Syria, where there's been interesting activity in the last week, to say the least. Nancy Youssef joins us this hour. She's with McClatchy Newspapers in Cairo, Egypt. Covers the Middle East, Islamic world out of Cairo. Samer Shahada is with us from Washington. He's a professor of Arab politics at Georgetown University, knows Egypt very well. And from Cairo, Egyptian journalist, blogger, and activist Gigi Ibrahim is with us. She was the heart of the Tahrir Square protest 2 years ago, and she is still very active in political opposition there in Egypt. Samer, here's Jason online, one of many, but says, a conflict between brutal authority and populist chaos. Egypt needs a middle path. Is there a middle path to be had here, Samer?
Well, I think the path is compromise, and certainly, I believe at least, we've seen that from some of the opposition, from Mohamed El-Baradei, from essentially what's called the National Salvation Front, a group of individuals and political currents who have, as well as others, you know, a bit more radical, who have proposed some measures to get us out of this impasse. And they have to do with things like, as I said before, including the opposition in the political process. The Constitution is a perfect example of this. It is a constitution that was produced by non-democratic means and then jammed down Egyptians' throat. In addition to some of the measures that have been mentioned before with the Muslim Brotherhood trying to dominate political life. So I think compromise is possible, and we'll see if Mr. Morsi and his Muslim Brotherhood Freedom and Justice Party are willing to make some of those concessions that would lead us out of this impasse.
Hassan is calling from Quincy, Massachusetts. Hassan, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Those people are not Muslim people. They're just power-grabbing, have their warped interpretation of the Quran. If Morsi was Muslim, he would forgive Mubarak, because that's what the Prophet Muhammad have taught us, is to forgive when you are able. But these people, they cut the hand of the people who steal, which it says nick, not cut. These people have their own warped interpretation, as I said earlier. If they were Muslim people, my father would have joined them. My father is Egyptian. I am Egyptian too. I was born in Egypt 70 years ago.
What about Morsi now, Mohamed Morsi now, Hassan? Should he stay in power or should he go?
No, he should go. What we should do now is bring Mubarak back and start over.
Bring Mubarak back. That sounds like a big... I mean, okay, we take the point, Hassan. Let me get one more. Emil is calling. Emil, you're on the air.
Yes, hi Tom, how are you?
Okay.
The reason I'm calling, after we have a new constitution in Egypt, we should hold a new election, national election for the president. We should get a new election and we see which one we, the Egyptian people like, a new agenda, because everybody knows the Brotherhood, the Muslim Brotherhood agenda. I disappointed Mr. Mohamed Morsi. He's asking officially Mr. the President Obama to release a terrorist guy, Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman, who was the responsible for the World Trade Center bombing in 1993.
Yeah.
He asking President Obama to release him. What agenda he carries?
But if there's a new election, Emil, if there's a new election, what's to say that the Muslim Brotherhood candidate would not win again?
I don't think so. They won again after what happened in Egypt, after the killing, after the abusing of the Egyptian people. We all watch TV and we see the guy. He was naked on the street, beaten by the Egyptian forces. And when we asked the interior minister over there, he said, this is the order from, direct order from President Mohamed Morsi.
Yeah, we saw that video of the one of the people in the streets at one of these protests, naked. His family said the police sort of stripped his clothes off of him and beat him in the street. That was not pretty. Nancy Youssef, what about another change in the leadership of Egypt? Does that even look on the... like a possibility to you? And what about, we have other listeners looking at Egypt and saying, failed state. What about it, Nancy?
Well, I think of it right now as a potential illiberal democracy. You know, it's interesting that Emil says that the Muslim Brotherhood wouldn't win in the next election. But when you get outside of Cairo and you go into the villages, the Muslim Brotherhood right now is campaigning for the upcoming parliamentary elections, which we expect to happen in April. While the opposition is protesting, they're giving out food, they're cleaning up trash, they're providing free health care in an effort to essentially, some would argue, buy the vote and provide services that the government isn't providing. That in the absence of Morsi and his government providing trash pickup, they're doing it for them. And so for all the instability that we see on the streets, there are just as many people who don't see an alternative, who believe in the Muslim Brotherhood's message, and I think that's worth pointing out. And so as powerful as those images are on television, they don't tell the whole story, because in the back provinces, the Muslim Brotherhood is currently campaigning for the next election and see this as a real potential to shore up their power base, if you will, because then they can name, for example, a new prime minister. The constitution, which we've talked about, really gives a lot of power to the parliament, and their calculation is that with the majority of seats, that they'll be able to coalesce the power around them. So I think that's something to keep in mind.
Gigi Ibrahim, you know, many people in the West were thrilled with the kind of romance of the big crowds in Tahrir Square, young and secular and well-spoken and calling for democracy. But, you know, Nancy Youssef looks beyond Cairo, sees a lot of support for the Muslim Brotherhood. Maybe a lot of Egyptians do not want what you want, Gigi. What do you think?
Well, you know, it's not exactly like that, but I believe that the revolution was even romanticized to Egyptians in Egypt, you know.
Yeah.
We believed for the longest time that if we all go to Tahrir Square, you know, things will happen, but that's not the case. Let's remember what actually brought down Mubarak. What brought down Mubarak was the major labor strikes that took part on February 8th, 9th, and 10th. And without those and mass demonstrations together, Mubarak would not have stepped down. That's what put the country to a complete halt. But before this happened, we need to figure out a clear alternative. And this puts a huge weight on the leftists. Of the leftists in Egypt's shoulders, because, again, the Muslim Brotherhood are reformists. They definitely want to consolidate power. The liberals have failed to provide an alternative that would adhere to the complete radicalization of the streets, like we've seen. Like the National Salvation Front speaks in one direction and the street is completely in another direction, so they have no power over it. So I believe that the future of this revolution would rest in the leftist effort in providing a clear alternative that would adhere to the radical street and at the same time be able to seize power and take this system, this whole regime down and build the alternative power where you have people's councils, you have direct democracy. This is the Egypt we dreamed for, this is what we fought for, and that's what we're going to keep fighting. Will it happen? This depends on us. This depends on people like me, I think, and it depends on the leftist party that are staying true to the revolution and at the same time are trying to build a real party that's representative of what the street is.
Samra Shahada, you hear the determination from Gigi Ibrahim. Perhaps they'll succeed, perhaps they won't. If they don't, if we see more of this very unsettling chaos, what's it mean for this region, Samra?
Well, it's certainly worrying and worrying not only for Egypt, but for other states, because as you mentioned, Egypt is the most populous Arab country in the Arab world. And certainly, I think what happens in Egypt is looked on by other people in the region. It would not be a good omen for those in the Gulf, for example, who are beginning to struggle for some of the same things that Egyptians and Tunisians and Syrians are struggling for. It would provide an excuse for those regimes to say, look at Egypt and the chaos that democracy brings. We don't need elections or rule of law or independent courts in Saudi Arabia, in Bahrain, in those countries. So it would be very, very troubling.
That's all we have time for today, but we're so grateful to the three of you for bringing us right up to date. Samra Shahada at Georgetown University, thank you very much for joining us, Professor Shahada.
My pleasure.
Nancy Youssef with McClatchy Newspapers in Cairo. Thank you, Nancy.
Thank you for having me.
And Gigi Ibrahim, activist, journalist, blogger in Cairo, joining us today. Gigi Ibrahim, thank you so much for your time. In a moment, Syria and Iran threaten to retaliate for an Israeli airstrike in Syria. This is On Point. Syria and its ally Iran have threatened to retaliate for Israel's airstrike last Wednesday inside Syria, apparently confirmed yesterday by Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak. There's been new contact between Syria's opposition and Russia and the United States, and more mass killings inside Syria. Sam Dogger of the Wall Street Journal has been closely following developments there. He joins us now from Beirut. Sam Dogger, thank you very much for being here.
Sure, my pleasure.
Listen with us, if you would, Sam, to just a couple of things here. This was Syrian state television announcing an airstrike attack in Syria last Wednesday, apparently by Israel, translated here by the BBC.
They say that Israeli jets flew in fast, below radar level, and bombed a military research center, killing two workers and causing damage to several buildings.
And here, Sam, was the Israeli defense minister, Ehud Barak, kind of one way and another, indicating that, yes, indeed, it was Israel that had carried out that airstrike. This was at a security conference in Munich yesterday.
That's one another proof that when we say something, we mean it. We say that we don't think that it should be allowable to bring advanced weapon systems into Lebanon.
Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak. So, Sam, where does that leave our understanding of what happened last week, first of all, with the Israeli attack?
Sure. Well, basically, we have U.S. officials who've spoken to the media on condition of anonymity, confirming that the Israelis had struck a convoy that was transporting advanced Russian-made missiles from Syria into Lebanon. They were going to Hezbollah, the Iranian-backed group that's also allied to Syria. And we've got the Israeli defense minister basically, in a way, confirming that Israel had carried out the strike, but, giving little details, whether, it was a convoy or something else. And then you've got the Syrians still maintaining that what was hit was a military research facility on the outskirts of Damascus, northwest of Damascus. And, in fact, over the weekend on Saturday night, the Syrian state TV showed footage of what it said was the aftermath of the airstrike. It basically showed, sedans, vehicles, trucks, also what appeared to be like military vehicles in a parking lot that are like all of these vehicles have been sort of severely damaged. So this would suggest that maybe what was hit was a convoy. And then they showed as well, this is on Syrian TV again, the facility that was purportedly, damaged by the airstrike. But the damage was very moderate. I mean, we're talking about windows being unhinged and broken glass, that kind of damage.
Sam, we also have the Israeli defense minister predicting the imminent fall of the Syrian President Bashar Assad and Iran threatening retaliation for the Israeli airstrike last week. How is that threat of retaliation seen, and is there evidence that Israel knows something about Assad's longevity in his post there, or is that just political language?
I think it's probably the latter. I think we have to be very careful with these types of statements. I mean, people have been predicting the fall of Assad from the get-go. When the whole uprising started about 2 years ago, he's still there. I mean, I was in Damascus 10 days ago, and yes, things are bad. The regime is leading fierce battles, including right there, on the outskirts of Damascus. But the regime is still in control of the center of Damascus. They've made some, they've regained some ground recently. I mean, there's evidence of that in the provinces of Hama and Homs. These are central provinces. Yes, the regime is still fighting a very bitter battle up north in Idlib and Aleppo. These are a lot of the towns and villages in these two provinces are in the hands of the rebels. So things are bad. I mean, it's more of a very bloody stalemate at the moment. So I would sort of beg to differ with the assessment of the Israeli defense minister. As for what the Iranians are saying, I think again we have to be very careful with that. Both the Iranians and the Syrian regime have really chosen their words very carefully. They've condemned the Israeli aggression, the Zionist aggression. They've tried to link it to what's going on inside Syria, saying, these are proxies describing the rebels as proxies of Israel.
What about that stalemate? We've seen a top opposition leader in Europe talking with Joe Biden, talking with the Russians. Is that an indication that the opposition is worried they cannot bring this to a conclusion and they're willing to talk?
Well, I mean, absolutely. And I think the Maaz al-Khatib, the head of the Syrian National Coalition, this is the umbrella group, again, was on Al Jazeera today, just a couple of hours ago, you know, addressing Bashar al-Assad directly, saying, you know, let's talk, let's find a way to talk, because otherwise, you know, we're going to be faced with a total destruction of Syria. Because, again, we have a very bloody situation here. Both sides are committing some horrible atrocities, mainly in Aleppo. A lot of it is coming out. There's evidence that both sides are really doing a lot of bad things there. And civilians, at the end of the day, are paying the price. And obviously, the head of the National Coalition of the Syria Opposition Umbrella Group, Maaz al-Khatib, realizes that and realizes that people are really have reached their limit in terms of the suffering. I mean, he's asking the regime to release 160,000 people from prison. I mean, that's probably the number that we're aware of. It's probably more than that. And then the UN recently estimated the number of people killed in the conflict is getting close to 60,000. So the suffering is real on the ground.
Syria at its limit of suffering, maybe. We've thought we were at that limit before. Sam Dogger with the Wall Street Journal joining us today from Beirut. Sam, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
Tomorrow, we'll look at the coastline of the Northeast after Superstorm Sandy. New York's governor says, hey, maybe we shouldn't rebuild all of that. We'll look at when and where to rebuild. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.